Every week it seems there are reports about U.S. drones, unmanned, remote-controlled aerial vehicles, tracking down suspected terrorists in remote, unreachable areas of Yemen, Somalia, Libya, Pakistan. But drones may soon be coming to a place near you. The technology is almost as accessible and affordable as a toy. My daughters have a remote-controlled helicopter, $29.99, batteries included. That worries of its two tiny plastic blades. Now, it is a toy, too small to carry a camera, much less explosives. The only attack it can launch is on a father's shins.
Drones, in a sense, have been around as long as people have been flying remote-controlled airplanes, right? As long as hobbyists have been doing it.
Shane Harris is a journalist and author of The Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance State. We asked Mr. Harris and John Villasenor, a professor of electrical engineering at UCLA and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, to come into our studios to talk about drones over America, the benefits that many people see, and potential threats to homeland security and U.S. interests abroad. Shane Harris began talking about the potential uses many people see in drones.
The Customs and Border Protection Unit of the Homeland Security Department is experimenting with drones that are about the size of small birds for doing monitoring the border, monitoring people and traffic coming over the border. Drones have been used after natural disasters to go in and look for survivors. We actually saw that in Japan at the Fukushima plant. Drones were used to go in and inspect the facilities there. Imagine that you are running a SWAT team in a crisis, hostage crisis standoff situation. And rather than put one of your officers in harm's way to go inspect what's going on inside the house, you have a drone the size of a spider that can skitter up onto the windowsill and look inside the window and see what's going on. You're likely to see drones used in mass farming, where you might have crop dusters replaced by drones. You might have drones that go out and hover over livestock herds and actually herd cattle. Why not? You might see traffic helicopter pilots being replaced by drones. These are some of the near-term uses that really make a lot of sense and that the technology could do right now if it were put to use that way.
Could the same technology be used to fly a jumbo jet?
Theoretically, yes. Maybe one day UPS and FedEx will no longer have people flying their cargo planes. It could certainly be much more efficient. They could perhaps fly routes that human beings can't fly. They certainly don't have to take breaks the way that humans do. Then that sort of raises the question, well, would we ever feel comfortable, we people, getting on a Delta on an American Airlines flight that didn't have a pilot in it?
Well, and as you say, drones don't need brakes. So
right.
There's no cancellation because the crew just got in from Rochester and
sure.
they have to brake for 12 hours before
sure.
they can fly.
Absolutely.
Again. Let's bring in now John Villasenor, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Are there national security implications in all this?
I certainly think there are. One thing that I've noticed is that the dialogue is almost always carried out from our perspective. How should we use drones? Should we use drones? Should we expand our use of drones? And I think with the inevitable proliferation issues, we have to also consider the inverse problem, which is what happens when people consider using drones against us. And to the extent that drones are becoming significantly smaller, more widely available, and less expensive, it becomes more difficult to ensure that they don't fall into the wrong hands.
Carefully, could you give us an example?
Drones obviously fly. We have a society where we have walls and fences and gates to prevent people from going places that they shouldn't go. And if you can fly, you can obviously go over those walls and fences and gates. And so drones can do that and make it possible for a larger set of people to do that in ways that weren't possible or at least weren't easy before.
We've heard that Om Shumrikyo at one point was interested in acquiring drones. Do you know about that?
Yes, my understanding from reading the stories about that is that I believe it was helicopters that they were pondering using in some of the attacks they eventually did carry out in Tokyo, although I also understand that in the end they, of course, decided to use other means. But it's a sobering example because here you have a group of people who were absolutely bent on and, in fact, did create a terror attack. And
in the Tokyo subway system, in the
Tokyo,
remind people.
Yes, in the Tokyo subway system a number of years ago, and drones were absolutely on their radar screen. So it stands to reason that they will be on the radar screen of other such groups in the future.
What kind of different or advanced step does this represent about the threats that we can already identify?
I think what's notable about this is the speed at which the technology has changed. It's almost been while we weren't looking. If you look at what you can put in your pocket these days in terms of a smartphone, the capabilities that smartphones have, That same technology now makes it possible to have drones which can literally fit in a backpack or the trunk of a car or even the palm of your hand. And so you can imagine a world where you might be being attacked not by one drone but by a swarm of 150 of them. And how in the world would you defend against that? And you might consider that, well, at the cost of some very large amount of money, maybe you could put some defensive system that would actually somehow take these down, but then you'd have to be careful that you don't simply vaporize every poor sparrow that happens to fly near a government building. So it's a complicated situation.
Mm. Let's bring in Shane Harris again, author of The Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance State. As you see it, Mr. Harris, what are some of the implications for privacy?
No, I think there are really profound implications. The machines can do things that we can't do, mm-hmm. right? The machines can watch in ways that we can't watch. When you're talking about putting up a drone with a camera versus, you know, having a cop on a stakeout, let's say, sitting outside a house, it's a much more profound kind of sense of invasion, too, because now you're talking not just about the limits of surveillance being how many cops can we put on the street or how many helicopters can we put over the air, but really these very small systems, dozens of them, let's just say, over at pick a neighborhood, put them there. To me, that's really what we haven't kind of started to really address from the standpoint of how these things are going to start proliferating. And once they're out there, it's going to be very hard to pull them back, I think.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you both. Is there a kind of drone arms race going on where the major participants aren't just one, two, or three countries, but many more? Shane Harris first.
Yeah, I think that there is a race starting in this area. So there are right now about 50 countries that use surveillance drones. Not very many that use armed drones the way that we do. But a lot of the sort of rising superpowers, China being a great example, recently had a big air show where they displayed many of the drones that they're trying to build and sort of trumpeted the fact that in various animations that they put out for people to see that they're building drones that can go out and attack aircraft carriers that look suspiciously like U.S. aircraft carriers. So they are definitely sending a signal to us and to other countries that you're not the only ones who are going to be able to build these things and to fly them. We're there too, and we want it as well.
John Villasenor.
Yeah, the China case is particularly interesting. There was a detailed and very informative article in the Washington Post about the Chinese drone program, stating the Chinese apparently have an intent not only to develop these things, but to also aggressively market them on the international market.
So it's not only the 50 countries, including a very prominent and rich one like China, that might develop forms of the technology we'd have to worry about, but it's the 100 countries they can sell it to.
And that's a great point. And I think the reason this can happen is that this technology, in many ways, isn't much different than what you have in a smartphone or a tablet or a laptop computer. That's why all these people can have access to it. This isn't your father's drone where you had to be a very, very well-funded, very sophisticated military laboratory. In fact, a lot of the parts for these drones are available at electronic stores in every country in the world.
Without getting carried away and recognizing a lot of projections turn out very differently than what people thought, are we at the point where, I mean, if I feel something in the back of my neck, it's either a gnat or a Chinese drone?
Next year, no. I think if you feel something on the back of your neck, it's probably a mosquito. But 7, 8, 10, 15 years from now, it's certainly, I think, going to be possible to have drones that are incomprehensibly small by today's standards.
And affordable.
Not only affordable, but probably genuinely cheap.
Gentlemen, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Shane Harris, who's author of The Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance State, and John Villasenor of the Brookings Institution. We contacted the Department of Homeland Security for their perspective or reaction. They didn't get back to us for an interview or comment. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Sticking with science and technology for a moment, if you want to visit, say, YouTube, and you're in China, that will be pretty difficult, China, along with Burma, Iran, and many other countries, actively censor certain websites. There are ways around it, but they are usually temporary fixes. Well, now, a group out of the University of Michigan has come up with software that basically disguises websites and allows users anywhere in the world to access any site they want. It's called Telex. Alex Halderman, an assistant professor of computer science at the university, is behind the program, and he says right now, in many authoritarian countries, the state deploys a firewall between their own internet systems and the rest of the world.
Citizens in these countries have been trying various ways to get around this for years. One of the most common today is to use what we call proxy servers, third-party servers outside of the country doing the censorship that receive connections from people inside the countries and then bounce them off to whatever censored website the user wants.
But once the government finds out about it, they can just ban it.
That's right. It turns into a cat-and-mouse game.
So say I'm in China, and I've got Telex. First thing, is it software that I've installed on my computer? How do I get it?
Well, there are two parts. First, there's software that you install on your computer, and then there are devices that we call Telex stations that internet service providers outside of the country doing the censorship put on the pipes of the internet, that is, on the wires that are carrying traffic to websites. You in the country, you might get a copy of Telex from a friend who's just passed it to you. You might get it from a website that was temporarily available before the government censors found it.
And then what happens? So I've got the software on my computer, and how do I access a banned website at that point?
So after the user installs the Telex software, their computer makes a connection to some website that is not banned. It can be any website the user would normally visit that's outside of that country.
Uh-huh.
So it could be, say, a web page about people's favorite cats. It's something completely innocuous, as long as it's hosted in another country. That connection passes through the government censorship since it's not on the blacklist. But then these devices at ISPs that we call Telex stations recognize that connection as a request for anti-censorship service and secretly divert it to a site that's been blocked that the user wants to access. We like to envision this technology as a potential government-level response to government-level censorship. So if a country that wanted to oppose internet censorship were to provide incentives to its ISPs to deploy Telex, that would allow the system to provide anti-censorship service to people all around the world.
Alex Halderman, let me ask you this question. What about a reverse use of the software? I mean, say, for example, there was a terrorist organization planning to carry out an attack in the U.S., and they wanted to go to websites that would attract the interest of the FBI or other investigators. Couldn't they use a software to view those sites as well?
Unfortunately, there are already effective ways that terrorists could potentially visit websites like that without being tracked down, say, by using open Wi-Fi connections, by using anonymity technology that already exists. I feel that the Telex technology doesn't make that substantially easier for them, but what it does do is make it substantially easier for people to access content that is censored in their countries.
That's Alex Halderman. He's one of the creators of the anti-censorship software called Telex. Alex, thanks so much.
Thank you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
I'm Melissa Block, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. This week, we begin a series on China's return as a technological superpower. It was arguably the world's first such superpower, inventing the compass, gunpowder, and block printing. But Chinese science then languished for centuries. Now leaders in Beijing are pouring money into research and development. It's a kind of techno-nationalism. NPR's Louisa Lim reports on where all that money is going.
Up until 1893, the Chinese language didn't even have a word for science. That's how much of a latecomer China is to modern science. But recently, China's leaders have been making up for lost time. They've invested heavily in brain power, providing funds to lure home Chinese scientists working overseas. One is Fan Heng, a quantum computing expert. He moved from UCLA to the Chinese Academy of Sciences in 2005. A decade ago, he says, most scientists were desperate to leave China. But those same scientists are now desperate to tap into those funds to come back.
10 years ago, we want to go abroad to have experience, but now we want to come back to concentrate on our research. Gradually, the trend is changed completely. Some researchers want to go back to China, but there are not so many opportunities for them.
我一直强调, 中国的振兴不单
China cannot develop without developing science and technology, says Premier Wen Jiabao. So to date, two official schemes have brought back more than 3,100 top-flight academics, offering them tenured positions, research labs, and one-time bonuses. The brain gain is even more extensive when it comes to PhDs. That's according to the Monitor Group's Michael Zlenziger, who's written on the topic.
To me, 80,000 PhDs coming home from the States, from Europe, to work in Chinese laboratories is a pretty impressive number, especially when you consider that when it comes to things like clinical trials, you can run a lab bench in China for 20 cents of the dollar it costs in the United States.
And official spending on science will only increase, even as U.S. budgets are cut. China's R&D spending will be hiked to 2.2% of GDP in 2015, from 1.7% now, with a focus on specific fields like nanotechnology, clean energy and stem cell research.
They're putting a lot of money into this area, so I'm amazed how much money they've... And so when I look at the facilities and the equipment going into these places, it's first rate. It's as good as you see anywhere in any new facility in the world.
Alan Trounson is president of California Institute of Regenerative Medicine. He was blown away after visiting China for the first time in 5 years.
I'm rocked. I really am rocked with what this country can do in such a short time. So imagine the next 5 years or the next 10 years, and I would think it's very likely that the science here will be the dominant science probably in the world.
A hothouse of science now rising again.
Amid the headlines, even the White House science advisor John Holdren has admitted that if the U.S. doesn't improve its game, China could, as he put it, eat our lunch. Dennis Simon from the University of Oregon has advised the Chinese government on science policy. He puts the figures in context.
If you would compare in absolute dollars, the Chinese are spending about a third or a little bit more than what the U.S. Is putting into science and technology development. So over the last 2 years, China's spending on R&D has averaged over 20+% growth. And that's kind of a remarkable increase.
35 people have been confirmed dead.
But a recent deadly crash on what was supposed to be the world's most advanced high-speed rail network shows the perils of overreach. China spent $300 billion on the network, but it's been plagued by corruption, undermining safety standards. And so a proud technological achievement has become an embarrassment. Speaking before the accident, Dennis Simon told NPR that China's leadership was unsure their investment in science and technology was bearing fruit.
The anxiety, I think, that exists at the central leadership levels is that after spending all of this money and buying all of this equipment and training all of these people, they're still not seeing the bang for the buck, as we would say in the West. There is this kind of trepidation to break the mold. So we don't see a lot of radical innovation in China.
So what's holding China back? One answer could lie in a recent scientific scandal. A leading geologist sacked after accusations he embezzled $1.5 million of research funding to spend on his three mistresses. Indeed, the Chinese Academy of Science admitted it spent $44 million last year on overseas trips, official cars and conferences. A political culture of corruption, prestige projects and top-down obedience could be hindering China's scientific revolution. Louisa Lim, NPR News Beijing.
This week, NPR's Louisa Lim is reporting on China's rapid pursuit of high technology, and today she picks up with China's Sputnik moment. That was the announcement last November that China had overtaken the U.S. to produce the world's fastest supercomputer. Already, the Chinese have been overtaken by Japan, which has built a machine three times as fast. Louisa has been investigating the claims and counterclaims about China's supercomputing program.
Today, China boasts 61 out of the top 500 supercomputers in the world. That makes it second only to the U.S., which has 255. Jack Dongara at the University of Tennessee helps compile the list, and he spells out why this is significant.
The striking thing is, back in 2001, China had zero computers on the list. So China very quickly grew its high-performance computing capabilities and are now number two on the list in terms of the number of high-performance computers deployed.
As the publicity film says, China's government has prioritized the development of supercomputers, going, as they say, from zero to hero in just a decade. China may have only held the coveted top spot for 6 months, but it was a moment of intense national pride, especially at the home of the $60 million Tianhe 1A machine. It's in the National Supercomputer Center, a brand new purpose-built building in a brand new district of Tianjin near Beijing. I was given a tour by director Liu Guangming, who told me how he teased U.S. computer scientists about the title.
When we took the title of the fastest in the world, we weren't trying to be number one. I like to joke and say we took number one by mistake. The joke is you guys weren't making any progress, but I was making progress, so I became number one.
I have to say, it's not much to look at. It's basically a row of enormous cabinets that look a bit like enormous fridges, and they're all full of computing equipment, which is blinking away madly. But this is equivalent to quarter of a million home computers all linked together. Just think what that could do.
The key is that this supercomputer can fulfill our needs, including mineral exploration, for bioengineering, patents, pharmaceuticals, and gene sequencing. Supercomputers can do all these things, as well as 3D cartoons and animation.
But some are asking if the Tianhe 1A really can do all those things. It mainly uses American chips, CPUs from Intel, as well as GPUs, which are normally used for animation, from another American company, NVIDIA, and Chinese chips called Feitong. The problem is, much of the software available can only use the CPUs. Put another way, it's a bit like putting an airplane engine on top of a car engine and saying it's the fastest car in the world. But in fact, the car can mostly only run on its old car engine. China's fastest supercomputer is not using its full potential, according to Cao Jianwen, a Chinese Academy of Sciences software expert, who's called the supercomputer a games machine.
I'm not saying the computer's no good. I'm saying they publicized it wrongly. They said it was number one, but you can't use the GPUs. There isn't a single application that works well with both the GPUs and the CPUs. The real customers only use the CPUs. But most of the people who use the national supercomputer are animation and games people.
But supercomputer center director Liu Guangming dismisses criticisms about its effectiveness as simply wrong.
We've worked with the state oil company CNPC using their own trademark software. We've made a huge contribution to our country's energy development. That's enough for me. Anybody who says we're just playing games, well, they can go off and play by themselves. I don't care.
However, China's lagging far behind the U.S. in software development. Computer scientists here say just 10% of Beijing's investment goes to software, and not having their own applications could hold China back. Jack Dongara says it's still too early to tell whether China's most powerful supercomputer is simply an expensive white elephant.
This is a critical thing. So they have a race car, and now you have to build something around the race car in order to effectively use it. You can't just invest in the hardware. You need to make an investment across the board. Sometimes these ecosystems are out of balance, and as a result of that, the computer would be very hard to use.
Regardless, China is not sitting on its laurels. Three more supercomputer centers are under construction around the country, and Chinese scientists are working on their own all-Chinese chips. China may have held the number one spot for just 6 months, but it still has to prove it can innovate indigenous solutions rather than just importing them. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Beijing.
We turn now to the growing power of supercomputers. Supercomputers are crucial for analyzing complex problems like climate change and particle physics. But as they grow, so does their appetite for electricity. Reporter Lauren Sommer of member station KQED looks at efforts to make supercomputing more energy efficient.
Meet the Cray 1.
If you needed an icon for a supercomputer, you would use the Cray 1.
This 6-foot-tall tower of wires was the most powerful supercomputer the world had ever seen in 1976. Today, it's part of the Computer History Museum in Silicon Valley, where Dag Spicer is a senior curator.
It blew people's minds. It was so powerful, so fast.
Of course, in today's terms,
it's roughly equivalent to a first-generation iPhone from Apple.
The reason we don't play Angry Birds on a supercomputer today is thanks to something called Moore's Law.
Moore's Law is a prediction made by Intel co-founder Gordon Moore in 1965 that the number of transistors incorporated in a chip will double approximately every 12 months.
What that means is computer chips have gotten smaller and faster at an incredible rate over the last 5 decades, which leads us to...
This is our new Cray XE6 supercomputing system.
Also known as Hopper, the nickname that's used by computer scientist John Shelf and his colleagues at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. And right now, it's chewing on some complicated problems.
Particle accelerator design, we have fusion energy, and then we also have laser plasma inertial fusion simulation.
Okay, some very complicated problems. It's as powerful as 10,000 desktop computers. But in just a few years, Berkeley Lab will get a new model that's as powerful as 100,000 desktops. According to Moore's Law, that next generation supercomputer should be smaller. But
the problem is that now we can't make them go any faster.
Shelf says computer chips have hit a wall.
So we can cram more things in the chip, but if you make them go fast, it's so hot they'll melt.
If chips themselves aren't faster, supercomputers will simply have to add more and more of them to increase computing power, which means much more energy use. Hopper uses around 3 megawatts of electricity, about as much as 2,000 homes.
Projections say that at the end of the decade, we'd be at 100 megawatts if we continue.
That's enough power for a small city. The electricity bill alone would be roughly $100 million a year.
What that says is that our current approach to doing supercomputing is a dead end, and that we need to think of dramatically new ways to improve the efficiency of computing.
Shelf says that could be done with some very familiar technology.
Hello?
Cell phones have computer chips that are designed to be energy efficient, so your phone lasts longer on a charge. Shelf says, why not build a supercomputer with chips that combine millions of these small cell phone processors?
In using that approach, we're able to demonstrate an additional 80 times more energy efficiency than business as usual.
Which would mean a much more practical supercomputer. Whether or not it gets built depends on companies like Intel, who would design the chips. Shelf says Berkeley Lab hopes to use this cell phone-inspired computer to model some of the trickier effects of climate change, like rainfall patterns, ice sheet melt, and the effects of clouds.
It enables policymakers to have the tools they need to make important decisions that have trillion-dollar consequences.
That way, Shelf says, supercomputers could work on tomorrow's climate and energy challenges without contributing to the very problem they're trying to solve. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Sommer in San Francisco.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. Chinese authorities are trying to quash public outrage over a high-speed train crash last month that killed 40 people. The government has issued numerous directives to the media not to investigate the causes of the crash and instead to publish or broadcast stories of uplift and national unity. One order reads, "Do not question,
do not elaborate. David Bandersky has been monitoring coverage of the train accident in the Chinese media. He's a researcher at the University of Hong Kong's China Media Project. And David, are these directives working? Has the media obeyed the order to not do hard-hitting coverage of this story?
Well, the first ban, the ones that you just read there, media were quite successful in breaking through. Those were bans that were issued July 23rd, the day that the crash happened. So media were told to keep it positive, to focus on stories of great love in the face of great tragedy. And we sort of saw that happening the following day. But within 48 hours, we had media asking much tougher questions. And by the time Monday rolled around and Tuesday, we were seeing very hard-hitting coverage from media in China. And then we had another round of bans at the end of the week, basically 1 week through this tragedy. On July 29th, the Central Propaganda Department had had enough, and they said, stop it.
Some of those tougher questions that were being asked originally had to do with not just what caused the crash itself, but also what happened after. Was the investigation into this basically physically buried as they buried the wreckage of this train?
It certainly looked that way because we had a very short rescue effort. Many Chinese were watching this happen in real time on through the microblogs. People were posting video and photos and eyewitness accounts from Wenzhou. And it seemed that the rescue effort was really stopped too quickly. And the priority was to get the trains running again. And that angered a lot of Chinese people. So there weren't really, the answers weren't forthcoming. Why did this happen? The initial statement from the railway ministry was that it was a lightning strike. And then another response they had was to fire three local level railway ministers. So people are, and Chinese media again are saying, well, if it was a lightning strike, why are you firing party leaders? Why is that the response?
And when you say that the push was to get trains running again, there's an image that really crystallizes that, an image of another high-speed rail train passing over a viaduct under which is the wreckage of this destroyed train.
That's right. And that image did become quite emblematic, I think, of the problems here. So we saw that image in a really important story from the official government news agency, Xinhua News Agency, on Monday. And that was a story that actually was quite instrumental in encouraging a lot of Chinese media to push harder in their coverage.
Well, what about now? Have you seen a real retrenchment in the media in terms of how this train crash is being covered?
Well, we have seen a little bit of coverage since the second round of propaganda orders came last Friday, but we really haven't seen the kind of coverage that we saw last week. So we saw them ramping up on that Friday, the 29th, but that night, because of these propaganda directives, newspapers had to backpedal really fast, and a lot of them had to drop their coverage.
What does it say to you that the crackdown on the media about this story, about this high-speed rail crash, what does that say about the sensitivity of this issue and the primacy of high-speed rail for Chinese authorities?
Well, it does say quite a bit. The development of high-speed rail has been a major prestige project for a number of years. The Chinese government has poured billions and billions of dollars into this. And interestingly, as we saw the coverage this week, one of the concerns people had was that it was too fast. The growth was that it happened too fast and there wasn't enough oversight and concern about safety.
David Bandersky is a researcher at the University of Hong Kong's China Media Project. David, thanks very much.
Thanks.